This time is the 61 highway that runs by my door. I walk 61 highway till I give down in my knee.
Back in the 1960s and early 70s, William Ferris drove up and down Highway 61 in Mississippi, searching for the blues. Armed with a pen and pad, a small movie camera, and a tape recorder, Ferris set out to capture the sounds of homemade blues, music played in churches and living rooms and juke joints, music that would never appear on a record.
Yeah, my poor honey.
William Ferris has finally unearthed those hundreds of hours of recordings, interviews, songs, stories, after nearly 40 years, and he's written a book about it. It's a series of profiles called Give My Poor Heart Ease, Voices of the Mississippi Blues. Bill Ferris is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
How was this stretch of highway? Because Highway 61 actually goes from Louisiana all the way up to Minnesota, but this part of it, along the Mississippi, in the state of Mississippi, this is really the heartland. This is really where the blues begins. Why did it happen there?
Well, B.B. King once told me that explaining how the blues happened there is like explaining how life was first created on the floor of the ocean. It's a large African-American population from slavery to the present. And within that, those communities, the blues thrived and continues to thrive today in evolving into musics like hip-hop and gospel and rap. This is the home of John Lee Hooker, of B.B. King, Reverend C.L. Franklin, Aretha Franklin's father. The music that has flowed up Highway 61 is truly historic.
The book includes a CD and a DVD of audio and video recordings you took at the time. And I want to play one of the earliest recordings you made.
I got the water on your baby. And the stop all in my hand. I feel mistreated. Little girl don't care where I go.
That's Lee Kizzert, an unknown blues singer, somebody you just recorded in Tutwiler, Mississippi. He was already 65 years old, Bill Ferris, when you met and recorded him. Tell me about Lee Kizzert.
Well, he's one of many of the musicians in this book that I simply met, stumbled across and was told about, and we walked over to a high school auditorium and found a piano, and he sat down and played what we just heard.
He didn't earn a living playing music.
No. Like most of these musicians, they had other jobs that put bread on the table. But he had played earlier in his career. He had a band, and they played around the Delta, as he said, when the Delta was in her bloom, when Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith were traveling through. But he later learned to repair and tune pianos, and he worked with the piano in that way, as well as singing and playing it occasionally when people like me were wandering through.
How did you get into blues music, and what was it about it that spoke to you?
Well, I grew up on a farm outside of Vicksburg, and as a very young child, a lady who's featured in this book, Mary Gordon, took me to a black church on this farm, Rose Hill, on every first Sunday. And so I grew up listening to these hymns, and as I grew older, I realized that if I did not record these hymns and photograph the families there, one day they would be lost. And that was sort of the beginning of a long journey of recording not just that church service, but blues singers and storytellers blues is closely related to the spirituals that I heard, the same musical sound. One musician told me that when you, quote, cross over, you simply change my Jesus and put my baby in, and the music stays the same.
You recorded a group called the Southland Hummingbirds in a place called Lula, Mississippi, in 1968, and the track that you include on the CD in this book is called There Are Days.
Love, there are days.
There are days.
I like to be.
I like to be.
I like to be.
Oh.
Tell me about this group, the Southland Hummingbirds. What was it like to hear them, and where did you record them?
I recorded them in a little four-room house with a single light bulb hanging from the middle of the room, and they gathered in front of a single microphone and began to sing, and the feet were moving to the beat, the call and response of the lead singer and the response of the other singers. A cappella, that was the deepest and clearest kind of gospel sound that I encountered, and it was especially moving.
Bill Ferris, how did you find the people you recorded? I mean, you were a young white man, a graduate student at the time in the 60s and the 70s, early 70s, driving in areas where I suspect many of the folks were suspicious of your motives or of what you were after.
Yeah, the 60s was in many ways a dangerous time if you were white to be traveling in black communities and recording.
If you were white and it was assumed you were a civil rights worker.
Yeah, it was just the unknown. I stayed in the black community and tried to stay out of sight of the authorities, and if I were stopped, I explained I was doing a book on the blues, and usually that was enough to be able to go on my way, but it was not a normal thing to do. Today, there are busloads of white tourists who come to the Delta to hear the blues. In the 60s, there was no one, and it was a lonely journey.
You also went to some of the penitentiaries in Mississippi along Highway 61, including a Parchman Penitentiary, and you recorded the inmates at a place known as Camp B in 1960, and I want to hear that recording.
Well, the high sheriff told the deputy, want you to go out and bring me louder.
Tell me what we're hearing here. This is a work chant.
Yes, they're basically chopping with hoes, and you have a leader who leads the chant, and then the gang who works in unison who echo each line. Again, this is a music that has roots in Africa, and it was a basic music that would have been familiar in slavery and well into the 20th century as a way of coordinating hard labor and pacing it so that people could get through the day and survive.
When you were doing this, Bill Ferris, blues music wasn't yet mainstream. It wasn't recognized for its importance, and obviously that changed. One can just go to Beale Street in Memphis today to see all those wonderful clubs. But today, some people worry that it's kind of fallen out or falling out of the mainstream again and sort of become the province of folklorists and historians like you. Does that worry you?
It does not. I think every generation fears this is the last time the blues and the ballad and whatever the form is will be heard. But life goes on. It will change, but it will not end. Willie Nelson once told B.B. when I was sitting with him, said, B, I've stolen some of my best licks from you. And B.B. said, well, I'm proud to know that. So the blues goes on, and it certainly will change and be different. 100 years from now, we can only imagine what the blues will sound like, but it certainly will be alive and well.
William Ferris is a folklorist and the author of Give My Poor Heart Ease, Voices of the Mississippi Blues. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Bill Ferris, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Well, she's a no good, don't it? And she don't mean no one man no good.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're going to stretch out a bit in this part of the program for some extended music and conversation with two musicians, one Irish and one Czech. Together, Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova are The Swell Season, and my co-host Melissa Block talked with them when they were here in Washington.
You may have seen them in the movie titled Once. He played a busker on the streets of Dublin. She played the young Czech immigrant who stole his heart. This ballad from the movie, Falling Slowly, won the Academy Award for Best Original Song.
Take this sinking boat.
Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova came by our studios recently to sing and talk. Glenn had with him the same extremely battered guitar he played in that movie. It has three gaping holes. You can see right through to the struts inside.
Because when on the street, you tend to play a lot harder.
You used to busk all the time on the streets of Dublin.
Yeah, street musician for years. And using the guitar, you definitely bang it a lot louder to get the volume out.
Glenn Hansard tuned up that guitar, and he and Marketa started with the song Low Rising from their new album, Strict Joy.
3, 4.
I want to sit you down and talk. I want to pull back the veils and find out what it is I've done wrong. I want to tear these curtains down. I want you to meet me somewhere tonight in this old tourist town. And we'll go low rising. Because we've got to come up. We've got to come up low rising. There's no further for us to fall. Low rising. Till I feel we've had enough. And we're low rising. Oh, for the love of you. Take you to the rock. I want to jump right in and see what that big ocean's got. I want to turn this thing around. I want to drink with you all night until we both fall down. Until we go low rising. Because we've got to come. Gotta come up low rising. Cause there's no further for us to fall. Low rising. Till I fear we've had enough. And we're low rising.
Oh. It's the song Low Rising from the new CD Strict Joy by The Swell Season. That's Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova. They're here in our studios. Glenn, this is your song. Tell me about how this song came about.
Well, the song is kind of a redemption song, as in, like, you know, I really want to make this work. I want to make this situation where I want to be, you know, this idea that in life you want to, there's moments, you get these moments of inspiration where you just want to sit everyone you know in a room and say, look, I know that I've kind of fallen a bit behind, or I got a bit off the track, but listen, I've got it figured out and it's all going to work out. So it was a, you know, it's a kind of a, it's all going to work out type of song.
Was it written with anybody in mind?
Yeah, probably Ma.
Is she sitting in this room? Yeah. Was my next question.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, yeah, but I mean, you know, I guess it was.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that, Marquetta?
No.
You didn't assume that?
No, actually, no, I didn't.
Marquetta, you're watching Glenn now as if you're discovering something new about him.
Well, you know, I seem to discover a lot of stuff through his lyrics more than through his conversations with me. It's I think Irish men are a bit like that, you know. And but I really this is the first time I'm hearing this.
You know, and it's so interesting to me that you wouldn't assume it was about you, because for all of your fans who know the story of how you were both in the movie once and fell in love and became a couple, and as I understand it, are now no longer a couple but are still a musical team, I think we all assume all these songs that you've written, Glenn, and that you've written, Marquetta, are about the other. They're very intimate songs, and they're, I think, excruciatingly painful songs, some of
really?
Them. Some of them.
Okay.
You don't see them that way.
No, it's like, so, it's almost like this, you know, God, it's a difficult, you know, it's just great. Now we're already into the deep stuff.
We have to get that out of the way first.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes when you write a good song can have many different, you can take it many different ways. You know, in a lot of ways you got to trust the art and not the artist. And so in a way, us not discussing with each other the direct meaning of each song, it's kind of protecting the song more than it's protecting each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah. One of your songs, Marquetta, on the new CD is called I Have Loved You Wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this just beautifully wistful, sort of confessional, really written, the first lines anyway, like a confession.
Forgive me, lover, for I have sinned, for I have done you wrong.
What can you tell us about where that song was written and how it came about?
Well, I think that the core of the song is this idea that, you know, we all make mistakes in life, and through making mistakes and through suffering, you learn, you know, things about yourself and about the world, and then it's kind of put into the frame of a love story, you know. Within a relationship, there's always going to be times where, you know, where you do each other wrong, you know. Part of the song as well is kind of not holding grudges against people, you know, because I really do see everybody in my life as teachers, you know, and who have important lessons to teach me. And ultimately, whether they're teaching me through hurt or through joy, I ultimately am really grateful to every single person like that.
So far.
Glenn, do you remember hearing this song from Marquetta for the first time?
Yeah, I remember. I was in Amsterdam doing a gig with the Frames, my band, and Mar was on the other end of the phone. And we were chatting, and she was like, "Oh, I wrote this new song," and she played me the song on the phone, and I was really devastated by it. I thought it was really amazing, and at the same time, I was like, it was kind of prophetic, you know.
What do you mean it was prophetic?
When Mar wrote "Forgive Me, Lover, for I've Sinned, I've Loved You Wrong, and I've Let You Go." That was a year before we split up. So it's, in a way, that's, you know, just to sort of put it straight, it's that thing of like, you see it coming. But even so, the song sees it coming. It's almost like you don't logically see anything, but for some reason, if you're honest and you allow the stuff to come from within, and you don't edit, and you really just allow whatever's coming through you to come through, oftentimes you're predicting the future, you know.
Marquetta, is it harder to sing this song now, knowing what's happened, that
No.
The things you were talking about actually did happen, that your relationship didn't survive?
No, I feel great peace about things that, you know, the way things have gone, I really do. For me, it doesn't create pain, you know, or it's not, doesn't break my heart, it just, like I said, it's I think it really the song is written from a place of peace and acceptance. You know, sometimes you know you're just not going to understand. Sometimes things don't make much sense, and that once you accept them, that's enough.
Oh my mind. Oh.
The song I Have Loved You Wrong by The Swell Season, Marketa Irglova, and Glenn Hansard, who are here in our studios. Thanks so much for coming in, and I wonder if you'd take us out with another song. Is there another one you'd like to do?
Yeah, we'll do another one.
So what are you going to play for us?
We'll play in this is a song called In These Arms, and I guess this song contradicts most of what we've been talking about.
Why not?
The song is kind of like, you know, sometimes you have that thing where, you know, I was born to love you. That's the, you know.
We're going to go out on an up note here.
Yeah. Okay. One, two, three. Use the truth as a weapon to beat up all your friends. Every chink in the armor, an excuse to cause offense. And the boys from the hallway are calling out your name. And true love will find them in the end. You were restless, and I was somewhere less secure. So I went running to the road. And so now there's this long list of places we were. But I've quit my rambling and come home. 'Cause maybe I was born to hold. Maybe I was born to hold you in these arms.
Glenn Hansard and Marketa Irglova are The Swell Season. You can hear more of our conversation at nprmusic.org. We talk about the poem that inspired the album's title, Strict Joy. And there's a video of them performing live here at NPR.
Maybe I was born to hold you in these arms. Maybe I was born to hold. Maybe I was born to hold you in these arms. Maybe I was born to hold you in these arms.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame celebrated 25 years at Madison Square Garden in New York City last night. The first of two concerts offered a lineup of rock and roll heroes: Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, Simon and Garfunkel, Crosby, Stills and Nash. Our critic Will Hermes was there and offers this review.
Welcome to the party!
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has a perpetual problem whenever it stages an event. How do you fairly represent rock's hardscrabble spirit and history in the context of what often seems like a backslapping soiree of superstars? Last night's concert, for all its great moments, was no different.
I said, come on over, baby. We got chicken in the barn. Woo, honey.
After a musical benediction by Jerry Lee Lewis, Crosby, Stills, and Nash played some of their hits, then brought out Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and James Taylor to play some of theirs. It was a 70s Southern California love-in, and everyone sounded pretty great. But aside from a beautifully sloppy cover of the Allman Brothers' Midnight Rider, rock history seemed to be only about songs these very famous artists made famous themselves.
I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me out.
Paul Simon did a slightly more ambitious job of telling rock and roll's history, to paraphrase the concert's advertised mission. In between his solo material and a set with Art Garfunkel, he brought out Dion DiMucci, who sang his 1961 hit The Wanderer. Then Simon handed the stage off to doo-wop legends Little Anthony and the Imperials.
Just two kinds of people in the world. They are a boy and girl.
If anyone was entitled to sing his catalog, it was Stevie Wonder. But his first song was Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind. And then a cover of Michael Jackson's The Way You Make Me Feel reconnected the late troubled King of Pop to the magnificent Motown lineage that raised him into its greatest star. The set went even higher with a version of Superstition that added guitarist Jeff Beck for extra fire. Finally, Bruce Springsteen took the stage for a two-hour overtime session. And in one of those endlessly amazing displays of Springsteenianism, he managed to gracefully acknowledge every one of the evening's problems and contradictions while simultaneously transcending them. He played to the cheap seats, cracking wise about the ticket prices, which topped $2,000. He decried homelessness and the stock market scandal to a crowd that looked to me like it contained a sizable Wall Street contingent. And he gave much of his set over to legends less famous than himself, like Sam and Dave's Sam Moore and Darlene Love, the voice of countless Phil Spector recordings and one of just two women in this rock and roll men's room. Bruce ended by noting that Darlene Love, somewhat shamefully, has yet to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But after their performance, which was the night's most joyous, that should change. And in my mind, that sort of triumph is what rock and roll's history is all about.
That's critic Will Hermes. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame celebration continues with the second concert tonight.
Next, we're going to hear a grand celebration of a modest highway. It's the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway. It snakes between warehouses and apartments in New York City. This battered old roadway turns up in the movie Quick Change. Bill Murray and Gina Davis play bank robbers asking for directions to the BQE.
Want to get on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway?
Wow!
The BQE!
Wow, you know, geez, we don't know where that is.
In the movie, a pair of construction workers cannot direct them, even though they just took down a sign that once pointed the way.
So I want to thank you guys. You could have given us help, but you've given us so much more.
Hey, that's what we're here for, right?
This expressway has not turned up in very many other works of art. Until now, the musician Sufjan Stevens made it his inspiration for an album called The BQE. He created a soundtrack for an expressway that may resemble a road you take every day. It's clogged with cars and perpetually under construction. Stevens begins with a steady electric sound that feels like a traffic jam. Stevens spent months on this roadway watching the expressions on his fellow drivers' faces.
It's sheer horror or resentment, anger. It's man transformed into beast, and there's vindictiveness and then hopelessness. It's a great insight into the psychology of man, is put a human being behind the wheel of a car and put him on the BQE.
Thank you. So just as I kind of get my shoulders really tense from listening to that intense and lengthy noise, suddenly I hear what sounds almost like Gershwin music to me.
Right. Well, this movement has a certain sort of respect for Brooklyn. It's called In the Countenance of Kings, and obviously that's a play on words for Kings County, which is Brooklyn. And I think it's a real, almost like a love poem for Brooklyn. It's looking at all the buildings and the roads and the people, and it's sort of a romantic view of Brooklyn.
Romantic, even though parts of it are decayed, like this roadway that you put at the center of your piece here.
Yeah, I mean, my job as an artist is to find beauty where there's ugliness. And I think this project is all about the beautification of a dilapidated, you know, object of scorn. I would have a hard time writing a piece about the Brooklyn Bridge or Grand Army Plaza, because these, to me, are museum pieces, and they have sort of an inflated history. And, you know, I can't really get my hands around these objects because they're so iconic.
I had a sudden image of children dancing in a field somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, this is also a score to a film. And in the film, I introduce these hula hoopers that sort of act as these kind of like enlightened beings, you know.
As hula hoopers so often are.
Yeah. It's sort of a trance-like sport.
Just so I understand, did you import hula hoopers to the BQE, or are they a natural phenomenon there?
No, I imported them. They're imposed. It's sort of comes from that whole tradition of ceremoniously opening up a roadway in the 50s in which they would bring in a marching band and there would be baton twirlers. And I think the hula hoopers are sort of related to the baton twirlers.
This music makes me want to talk in a newsreel announcer voice. Spanning the globe! A new highway opens in New York City! That's what you're thinking of there, is those old newsreels with the ribbon cutting or smashing a bottle of champagne on the highway or whatever
yeah.
they may have done.
I mean, so much of this score is beautifully dated. You know, I spent so much time meditating on this object of the 50s. Everything began to feel really sort of heightened and romantic.
Do you, on balance, like driving on the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway?
I can't get enough of it. I've spent 9 months of my life driving back and forth, filming this project and writing the score. And I think through that I reached enlightenment. Traffic no longer bothers me. And I love that they're constantly renovating it and it's changing. And I notice all the little places where they're adding shoulders and rebuttressing and repainting.
I feel like I'm talking with a character from Siddhartha. the novel about the guy who goes through different stages of life seeking wisdom and ends up as a simple ferry boat.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of this piece is about enlightenment. It's transcending the mundane elements of everyday life and finding inner peace. So you have to find your little quiet corner of solitude.
And your quiet corner just happens to be stuck in traffic.
Exactly. It's where I belong.
Sufjan Stevens is a resident of Brooklyn and composer of the BQE, commissioned by the Brooklyn Academy of Music. See the video that goes with that music at nprmusic.org.